KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. I'm Catherine Barron. On today's show, the razzle and reality of Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's trade mission to China. Also, the not-so-trendy side of LA's busy garment district.
Workers were sitting at their machines for hours and hours at a time, poor ventilation in the factories, and the workers over time start developing debilitating injuries.
And Berkeley Repertory Theater restages a children's opera first performed in a Nazi concentration camp.
There were hundreds of children there in the audience. And after their last performance, most of the children were sent to their deaths.
Those stories and an ode to Highway 1. It's the California Report. We begin this week where West meets East. Governor Schwarzenegger is wrapping up his trade mission to China. Business leaders, eager for an entree into the massive Chinese market, tagged along on the trip, paying $10,000 apiece for the privilege. KPCC reporter Rob Schmidt spoke with us from Shanghai. I asked him whether the governor and the mission opened doors for California businesses.
Definitely. Actually, I was talking to someone last night at the Harry Potter premiere, and I asked him, hey, was that $10,000 worth it? And he said, are you kidding me? This is Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's able to do things that many other politicians can't do. And he told me, look, Gray Davis, if he came here, do you think we'd be having events like this? And, you know, I think he had a good point. I mean, Schwarzenegger's star power is quite large here in China. And I think that Schwarzenegger is keen enough to use that star power to his advantage on a trade mission like this.
So you mentioned the Harry Potter event. That's part of the move to try to quash piracy over there, right?
That's right. It was designed to give a message to the Chinese that they have other avenues of enjoying films from America, not only buying them on pirated DVD now, but the theaters here, movie theaters in China are few and far between. They're only in the large cities, and they actually cost quite a bit of money for most Chinese. I believe a ticket here is around 60 renminbi, which is about around 7 or 8 U.S. dollars, and that's a lot of money for most Chinese. That's around at least half a day's wage.
So this whole issue of piracy really is one that it seemed the governor was keen to get some kind of agreement on, though, or assistance promised from the government in China. Did that happen?
I don't think that he came in here expecting an agreement from the government, per se, but I think what he was trying to do when he came here with regards to intellectual property rights was that he wanted to raise awareness about it. In Hong Kong, he'll be meeting with Jackie Chan. They'll actually be releasing a public service announcement that will tell folks, hey, you know, intellectual property violations not only hurt the entertainment industry in California, but it also will hurt China in the long run as China becomes an entertainment industry giant, because, you know, in the recent years, we've seen more and more films that appeal to American audiences as well from China.
I'm wondering what some of the most surprising moments have been on this trip. And one thing I was thinking of is when the governor spoke to the students at the university in Beijing early on and really gave a very American-style speech. How did that go over? What was the sense there?
That specific speech actually was, I think, for many of the students there, and I talked to a lot of them afterwards, was very moving. It was something that they didn't expect from a Hollywood movie star. And it was a very inspirational speech because Arnold really talked about himself. He talked about the barriers that he overcame throughout his life. And, you know, I think he made a lot of interesting comments in that speech. He said, you know, if I could change my body, I learned that I could change not only my body, but I could change my environment, and possibly I could change, you know, in some ways he was insinuating he could change society. And that's an interesting idea in this context, and I think that it really hit home with a lot of these students. Obviously, they, you know, and a lot of this was about dreams, and obviously they're living a dream by just being at that university, but I think that a lot of students were hoping that the message would also get out beyond that university.
That was KPCC reporter Rob Schmitz traveling with Governor Schwarzenegger in China. Although the governor didn't include it on this trip, one industry that's been greatly affected by trade negotiations is garment manufacturing. Since free trade agreements first took effect 11 years ago, California garment workers and factory owners have steadily been losing jobs and business to foreign competition. Reporter Jason Margolis visited downtown Los Angeles to examine the effects of free trade on one of the nation's largest garment districts.
A decade ago, nearly 100,000 people worked within these few square blocks, just east of the skyscrapers of downtown L.A. Today, that number has fallen by more than 35%. The streets are still very much bustling and alive with chaotic activity. Young men push clothing carts and weave in and out of foot traffic as clothing moves from factories straight to the shops.
At the ground level, you'll see a lot of the shops with the windows full of the goods and other products. And then as you move your eye upward, you'll see the actual factory where a lot of the workers are upstairs sewing the very garments that are either being sold in the shops right below.
Rini Chakraborty is the executive director of Sweatshop Watch, a group dedicated to ending workplace exploitation within the garment industry. According to a U.S. Department of Labor study conducted in the year 2000, two out of every three garment shops in Southern California fail to comply with minimum wage and overtime standards. Chakraborty points to a state survey that found 98% of the factories here failed to meet inspections for health and safety.
Unsanitary bathroom conditions, workers who are sitting at their machines for hours and hours at a time, poor ventilation in the factories, and by and large, because of these poor working conditions, a lot of the workers over time start developing debilitating injuries or injuries that are untreated because they don't have health care.
Chakraborty and many other labor rights groups say recent trade agreements are part of the reason working conditions continue to decline. It began with the North American Free Trade Agreement 11 years ago. Then, on January 1st, import quotas were lifted, flooding the U.S. markets with even more cheap goods, largely from China and Mexico. Many American factory owners in Los Angeles closed up shop. Others have pushed their work underground.
The informal sector is the only part of L.A.'s labor market that is growing. It's the energized part of our labor market.
Dan Flaming is the president of the public policy research group, the Economic Roundtable, which analyzes business issues in Los Angeles. He says factory owners can still find plenty of people to work, even at $3 or $4 an hour. Most of the sewing machine operators and thread cutters are immigrant women, largely from Mexico, China, and Korea.
People accept informal jobs because they don't have better choices. And reasons why people might not have better choices include lack of legal documentation for working. It also includes simply not being able to compete for a job in the formal economy, not being able to get into one of those limited number of good jobs.
Even though many garment workers are legal citizens, most don't want to speak out or talk to the media for fear of losing their jobs. This 49-year-old woman who asked to be identified only as Lucy was an accountant back in Beijing. She moved to Los Angeles 8 years ago so her son could get a better education. She says in the past few years, finding work has become especially tough.
Usually I work 40 hours a week, but lately the economy hasn't been good, so the owner has transferred a lot of the work to China or Taiwan. So sometimes it's 3 days or 4 days that I go into work. There's nothing I can do. I can just wait and hope that the factory owner will call me and tell me to come into work.
She says life was better in China. Here she eats rice and cheap vegetables or fish at home, never in a restaurant.
There's no protections for workers. We have to live in the simplest way in order to survive. In the U.S., people change their clothes every day. That's the social standard here. But workers making these clothes are exploited. The government knows, the business people know, but they're not willing to solve this problem.
Factory owners say they're being hurt as well, squeezed between retailers demanding cheaper products and stringent state labor laws. 6 years ago, California passed what is considered the strongest anti-sweatshop legislation in the nation. When factories underpay workers, the owner and the retailer who buys from that factory are held liable. and workers can file claims without going through the courts. Joe Rodriguez directs the Garment Contractors Association of Southern California, which represents roughly 200 factory owners. He doesn't discount that there are plenty of bad actors, but he says the average garment factory is subject to higher standards, more scrutiny, more often than other types of businesses.
See, I maintain, for example, that if you send a team of inspectors to any Fortune 500 company, you're going to find labor violations if they stay there long enough. Labor inspection, if it's really, really detailed and intensive, can uncover a lot of different things. Most of them are going to be peccadilloes, penny ante stuff. Well, I've said to the state for a long time, don't do that. Go in and just look for the most egregious violators, the worst rotten apples.
But finding those rotten apples and holding them accountable has been a problem. The California Department of Labor Standards Enforcement has suffered severe staffing cuts in recent years. Today, the agency has only 11 inspectors statewide dedicated to monitoring garment factories. Even when bad factory owners are caught, it can be tough to get them to pay. According to a recent study by the Asian Pacific American Legal Center, workers receive, on average, only 31% of the wages they're legally entitled to recover. For the California Report, I'm Jason Margolis in Los Angeles.
Come on, admit it. You like getting some email, and so do we. So go ahead, send us your questions or comments about the California Report. Our address is calreport@kqed.org. That's calreport@kqed.org. Please be sure to tell us your name, how you pronounce it, and where you're from. And if you missed a story on the California Report, just visit our website. It's californiareport.org. You're listening to the California Report. A children's opera called Brundibar opened this week at the Berkeley Repertory Theater. This operatic fable of innocence defeating evil was originally written by a Czech composer and was first performed by Jewish children in a Nazi concentration camp. In recent years, acclaimed playwright Tony Kushner teamed up with Maurice Sendak, author of such classic children's books as Where the Wild Things Are, to restage Brundibar. Judy Campbell reports.
Brundibar is a simple story about two kids who live in the country.
And one day their mother wakes up and she's very sick, and they call the doctor in, and the doctor says, you have to run into town and get her milk.
Which they do, says playwright Tony Kushner, who adapted the libretto. But the kids don't have any money for the milk, and when they sing for coins, a bully organ grinder, that's Brundibar, drives the kids away.
Little children, how I hate them, how I wish the bedbugs ate them, how their parents overrate them, if they're rude, exterminate them.
Against a magical set designed by Maurice Sendak, which seems to have popped straight out of one of his books, the village animals and children band together against the bully.
Tyranny, despotism, dictators are defeated not by a single person's action, but by good people banding together as a group. And as a group, you can overcome a stronger adversary. So it's a piece about solidarity.
For help is everywhere, below and in the air.
Zavíš, ten a buben, válku jsme vyhráli. Vyhráli proto jen, že jsme se...
Ella Weisberger was 11 when the opera was first performed in the Nazi camp of Terezin. She played the role of the cat.
Do kroku zpívali. When we sang, we forgot where we were. We forgot hunger. We forgot all the troubles that we had to go as children through. As Mrs. Nami Rat. That's the victory song.
Terezin was a model ghetto that Nazi officials showed off to visiting dignitaries. Nazis encouraged the opera and featured it in a grand ruse, a propaganda film called The Führer Gives the Jews a City. The opera was sung in Czech, so Weisberger says the Nazis weren't aware that the finale became an explicit song of defiance.
The victory song was for us such a powerful thing to sing that we overcame Hitler, because in our eyes, Brundibar was Hitler. People started to sing with us, clap hands, you know, stomp the feet, and we were repeating the victory song till they said, you have to be by 8 o'clock home, so we had to stop.
The propaganda was well-crafted, but there's an eerie stillness to the children in the audience that hints at the truth.
There were hundreds of children there in the audience in the big theater. And after their last performance, most of the children were sent to their deaths in gas chambers in Auschwitz.
I can hardly bear to listen to it.
That's Maurice Sendak.
And emotionally, I just break down. But the sound of the children and the melodies in Brundibar, the sweetness of the victory song at the end, which is causing me such pain because there ain't no such thing as a victory.
Most of Sendak's books are, in some way, an attempt to come to terms with the Holocaust. Sendak's parents left Europe for the U.S. before the war, and he grew up under the shadow of family ghosts who didn't escape. But Kushner says both he and Sendak also wanted to rescue the opera from the pall of its history.
We felt very, very strongly that Brundibar was being done a disservice in a way, that the terrible circumstances under which it was first staged sort of overwhelmed the fact that it's this fantastically great little opera for kids, and it's beautiful.
The sets and costumes are fantastical. The music, delightful. Innocence triumphs. But as fans of Sendak know, he believes children intuit danger and devastation, and it shouldn't be covered up.
But just in case you should think it were too happy, you know, Tony added the last verse of Brundibar, which says, okay, you think you've won, but, you know, I'll be back again.
They believe I'm gone. Not quite. Nothing ever works out neatly. Bullies don't give up completely. One departs, the next appears, and we shall meet again, my dears. Though I go, I won't go far. I'll be back. The Brundibar.
And that's the true ending of the opera. You know, that you have to keep knocking evil on the head every periodically. And God knows I've lived long enough, so I don't believe for a minute that it'll ever end.
And so we end our song.
For the California Report, I'm Judy Campbell.
Brundibar is at Berkeley Rep through December 28th. That's the California Report for this week, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Danny Bringer is at the controls this week. We had additional engineering by Paul Lancour and Howard Gelman. Our interns are John Kane, Kasha Newman, and Allison Johnson. Our producers are Stacey Bond and Erica Kelly. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Susan Kennedy is our managing editor. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And special thanks this week to the National Center for Jewish Film at Brandeis University for providing archival material. I'm Catherine Barron. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Charitable Auto Resources, a full-service vehicle donation program management firm, which helps nonprofit organizations increase their revenue. Online at charitableautoresources.com. TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good. TIAA-CREF.org. And the Stewart Foundation, for coverage of important issues in public education.